This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of May 2nd. The humble pope who preached social justice, Pope Francis, 1936 through 2025. Pope Francis was a pontiff of firsts. Born Jorge Mario Bergoglio to a family of modest means in Argentina, he was the first pope from the Americas and the first non-European in more than 1,200 years. Chosen in 2013, he was the first Jesuit pope and the first to take the name Francis in honor of St. Francis of Assisi, the 13th century saint known for his devotion to the downtrodden. The name was a sign of the ministry to follow. Declaring his desire for a church that is poor and for the poor, Francis wore $20 plastic watches, placed his own phone calls, traveled Rome in a Ford Focus instead of a bulletproof limo, and spurned quarters in the Apostolic Palace for a two-room Vatican guest house. Politically outspoken, he urged compassion for migrants, besieged wealthy nations to battle climate change and social inequality, and called capitalist greed the drug of the devil. Widely beloved for his warmth and lack of pretense, Francis also drew the ire of conservatives who disapproved of his liberal moves, such as appointing many women to senior Vatican roles and allowing priests to bless same-sex couples, and to absolve women for abortions. The Catholic Church should be a place of God's mercy and hope where all feel welcomed, loved, forgiven, and encouraged, he said in 2013. It must have doors wide open so that all may enter. Raised in Buenos Aires, Bergoglio was the eldest of five children born to Italian immigrants, said the Wall Street Journal. Bookish and diligent in high school, he studied chemistry while working the door at nightclubs, where he was known as a proficient tango dancer. While his mother wanted him to become a doctor, his life took a turn at 16 when he felt an urge to enter a church and confess his sins. There he was seized by a pull that changed my life, he later wrote. He entered the diocesan seminary, but later moved to the Jesuit order, drawn by its focus on social justice. After suffering pneumonia that led to a partial lung removal, he was ordained a priest in 1969 at 32. From there, his rise within the ranks was steady, said the Los Angeles Times. Within 4 years, he was named leader of Argentina's Jesuits. By 1998, he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. By 2001, a cardinal. His habits during those years foreshadowed the revolutionary changes in style that would mark his papacy, said the Washington Post. Bergoglio lived not in the archbishop's palace, but in a modest home, and he rode the bus and cooked his own meals. He spent long days ministering in the sprawling slums of the city and washed the feet of AIDS patients, drug dealers, and prostitutes. After Argentina suffered an economic collapse in 2001, he built relief operations, tending to the swelling ranks of the needy, and lobbied the government to address their plight. These works began to be noticed by his fellow cardinals, said CNN.com. With strong liberal backing, he was considered as a successor after John Paul II died in 2005, but the conservative Benedict XVI was named instead. When Benedict shocked the Catholic world by stepping down in 2013, the 76-year-old Bergoglio was no longer seen as a frontrunner. Yet, after an electrifying speech warning that a church which turns inward becomes sick and narcissistic, he became the surprise choice as the 266th pope. Francis inherited a deeply divided church, said Reuters. Rocked by the scandal around priestly sexual abuse, it faced falling attendance, a shortage of priests, and growing demands for a greater role for women and for ethnic diversity in leadership. From the start, he broke with tradition, said NPR.org. Rejecting the monarchical trappings of the papacy, he set about overhauling the Vatican bureaucracy and financial management, and building bridges with the Islamic world. He made his first papal trip to the southern Italian island of Lampedusa, a way station for migrants fleeing war and poverty in Africa. There, he denounced the globalization of indifference toward refugees and cast a wreath into the sea where many had drowned. Weeks later, speaking to reporters on a plane, he uttered a phrase that would define his papacy. Asked about a priest said to be gay, he responded, "Who am I to judge?" Headlines ricocheted around the globe. That insistence on shaking up the status quo earned him no shortage of enemies, said the New York Times. His avuncular charm and easy smile belied his steely reputation within the Vatican, and he clashed bitterly with traditionalists over his demotions of conservative officials and his push for a more inclusive church, including a refusal to back the denial of communion to Catholic politicians supporting abortion rights. Catholic conservatives in the U.S. bitterly opposed him, especially once he began criticizing then-candidate Donald Trump's plan to build a border wall. Francis called such a sentiment not Christian. Yet even as he enraged conservatives, he also disappointed many liberals who hoped he'd go further with progressive reform. Though he called for acceptance of homosexuality and non-traditional relationships, he rejected same-sex marriage. He also maintained a support for priestly celibacy, opposed women priests, and used a derogatory word in a discussion of admitting gays to the priesthood. Francis faced his biggest challenge over the church's sexual abuse scandal, said Bloomberg. Amid demands for reform and accountability for the decades of widespread abuses by clergy, he struggled to live up to expectations. Pledging to rid the church of this evil, he convened a 2019 summit, appointed a commission to address the problem, and issued an edict requiring priests and nuns to report abuse. But in 2018, he faced a crisis when he discredited abuse victims in Chile and backed a bishop there who was accused of covering up for abusive priests. U.S. Catholics, meanwhile, said Francis had ignored their warnings about an American cardinal, Theodore McCarrick, later removed for abuse of minors. And, despite his efforts, in the end, he largely failed to satisfy victims' demands for accountability. For his compassion and humanity, though, Francis was beloved by millions around the world, said The Guardian. Thronged by the faithful on his many travels, he cast aside security concerns to wade into crowds, kissing babies and laying hands on the sick. But as his health failed, his public life slowed. He suffered recurring respiratory infections, underwent colon and abdominal surgery, and developed mobility problems that put him in a wheelchair. Frail after a prolonged bout with pneumonia this year, he was unable to lead Holy Week services but managed an Easter blessing from the balcony at St. Peter's Basilica. The next morning, he died. In his will, he requested his tombstone say only Franciscus. The tomb, he said, must be in the earth, simple, without particular decoration. It wasn't all bad. 2-year-old Bowden Allen sparked a massive manhunt when he wandered away from his home in Yavapai County, Arizona. But 16 hours later, Allen was rescued by Buford, a 6-year-old Anatolian Pyrenees ranch dog at the Dunton Ranch. The toddler walked 7 miles across mountainous terrain and valleys and slept overnight beneath a tree in frigid conditions and with prowling mountain lions. But in the morning, Buford discovered him and alerted his owner, Scotty Dunton, who reported the boy found. While inspecting a line of cable in the Pompeian room in Rome's Villa Farnesina, electrician Davide Renzone mounted a scaffold and climbed through a trapdoor in the ceiling, discovering a second trapdoor leading to an upper ceiling covered in 17th century frescoes. "My first feeling was astonishment," said Renzoni. immense astonishment. The true ceiling depicting heavenly angels and rolling hills was likely painted by Baroque master Carlo Maratta and two students over 300 years ago. The trio apparently painted their own frescoes while hired to preserve Renaissance master Raphael's erotic fresco of Cupid and Psyche. But in the 1800s, the villa's owner redecorated the room in the style of ancient Pompeii, creating a false ceiling that hid Maratta's work until this rediscovery. After learning in January that his prostate cancer was terminal and he likely had only 18 months to live, Doug Rusch embarked on a new life mission, volunteering to help others in all 50 states. The San Antonio resident raised funds, packed all his belongings in his 2017 Chevrolet Malibu, and drove north. He's now reached Seattle, having already volunteered at food banks, senior centers, and other charitable organizations. Despite his diagnosis, Rusch says he's been so invigorated that he wakes up each morning feeling as if he were shot out of a cannon. A meltdown at Hegseth's Pentagon. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was fighting to hold on to his cabinet position this week after reports that he used a second signal chat, which included his wife, brother, and personal lawyer, last month to discuss detailed plans for a U.S. military strike on rebel camps in Yemen. The New York Times reported that Hegseth, a former Fox News host, had created chaos unmatched in the recent history of the Pentagon, and that after he fired three top aides last week and accused them of leaking to the press, his circle of advisors is in shambles. A fourth recently departed aide, former Pentagon spokesman John Ulyatt, said in a Politico column that the Defense Department is in a full-blown meltdown under Hegseth's leadership, and that it's hard to see him retaining his post. NPR reported that the Trump administration has begun a search for Hegseth's replacement. President Trump said Hegseth is doing a great job and denied seeking to replace him. Hegseth maintains the information he shared about the Yemen strikes on two signal chats, the first with a journalist mistakenly included, was informal and not classified. But NBC News reported that the plans Hegseth detailed came directly from a general using a secure government system. The inclusion of Hegseth's wife, a former Fox producer with no military background, in the chat has raised questions about her frequent presence in Hegseth's official meetings. While some Republicans are standing by Hegseth, GOP Representative Don Bacon called him an amateur and said he was acting like he's above the law. Hegseth is blaming the media and former disgruntled employees for his troubles, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, but the press didn't make up the staff turmoil or the embarrassing signal chat. The infighting, dismissals, and leaks look like the self-inflicted mistakes of a management neophyte. Hegseth vowed to be a disruptor of the status quo at the Pentagon, but as Republican Senator Mitch McConnell warned when he voted against Hegseth's confirmation, that's not a sufficient credential to be put in charge of America's defense and 3.4 million military and civilian employees. If he wants to keep his job, he needs to bring in competent, experienced staff. Actually, it's time for Hegseth to go, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. He's in way over his head and is undermining the military's effectiveness. A lower-level employee would have been fired, if not criminally charged, for such flagrant misbehavior as boasting about an imminent U.S. attack via a commercial app on his personal phone. Time to hand the job to someone who has the right experience and qualifications to lead one of the world's largest and most complex organizations. Trump doesn't want to sack Hegseth because he thinks it will only encourage and empower the press, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. But that's a dangerous game to play with national security. If Trump won't take a political loss now, what kind of geopolitical loss does he risk later? Courts rebuke Trump over deportations. A federal judge this week accused the Trump administration of ignoring court orders and acting in willful and bad faith in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who remains locked up in El Salvador despite a Supreme Court order that the administration facilitate his return. U.S. District Judge Paula Zinis blasted the administration for failing to answer questions about what it was doing to free the Maryland sheet metal worker and father of three, instead taking refuge behind vague and unsubstantiated assertions of privilege. Her order followed a blistering ruling from a federal appeals panel. The White House is claiming the right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without due process, which should be shocking to all Americans, wrote Judge Harvey Wilkinson, a Ronald Reagan appointee. The administration maintains that Abrego Garcia is a member of the MS-13 gang and that it has no power to retrieve him, though it is paying the Salvadoran government to imprison him. In a related case, the Supreme Court issued a rare late-night order temporarily barring the administration from deporting Venezuelan migrants being held in Texas under the 18th Century Alien Enemies Act. Only Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissented from the order. Trump, whose administration asked for permission to continue the deportations under other laws, took aim at the high court. He said his administration is being stymied at every turn by judges in its efforts to deport violent criminals and terrorists. The Supreme Court's order was an extraordinary rebuke of the Trump administration, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. For months, the High Court has granted Trump immense deference, but by rushing out the terse order at 1 a.m., the justices signaled they no longer trust the administration to comply with the law. It's a welcome sign that they're finally grappling with Trump's flaunting of constitutional norms. Democrats, too, are starting to understand this moment, said Joan Walsh in The Nation. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen showed them how to find their spines. Last week, he traveled to El Salvador and demanded a meeting with Abrego Garcia. While other Democrats complain there's nothing they can do for innocents rotting in El Salvador, Van Hollen proved otherwise. Turning Abrego Garcia into a cause célèbre is bizarre, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. While Trump tries to fix our broken immigration system, Democrats rallying around this illegal migrant and alleged gang member makes for poor optics and worse politics. Except Trump has offered no evidence Abrego Garcia is guilty of any crime, said Jonah Goldberg in the Dispatch. And whether he's a saint or a vicious criminal hardly matters. The question is whether a lawless administration can crush due process and ship a person to a foreign gulag. The only way to make sure you and I get constitutional protections is to make sure everyone gets them. Harvard, fighting Trump's assault on its independence. After one American institution after another caved to the irrational demands of a lunatic administration, one of them finally stood up and said no, said Charles P. Pierce in Esquire. The Trump administration recently sent Harvard University a list of outrageous demands, threatening to cancel nearly $9 billion in government funding unless Harvard agreed to regular federal audits of its hiring, admission, and disciplinary processes and of the viewpoint diversity of its professors and student body. Harvard President Alan Garber issued a public hell no, pledging that the university will not surrender its independence or relinquish its constitutional rights. Trump's retaliation was swift, said Erwin Cherminsky in the San Francisco Standard. In a blatantly illegal move, he canceled nearly $2.2 billion in grants without so much as a court hearing and is now threatening to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status. But unlike Columbia University and many major law firms that Trump has threatened to punish, The university is refusing to capitulate to his mafia-like extortion and quickly filed a federal lawsuit to halt his funding freeze. That should serve as an example to other institutions to stand up to his authoritarian decrees. Giving in to a bully never works. It's not bullying to tell Harvard to stop discriminating, said the Washington Times in an editorial. Trump is simply demanding that Harvard admit students and hire professors based on merit alone, not on skin color, ethnicity, or gender, and that it enforces its own disciplinary rules against students who engage in anti-Semitic harassment. If Harvard, which has a whopping $53 billion endowment, prefers to remain an activist indoctrination center, it should stop taking taxpayer money. Why should Americans fund a university where less than 2% of professors identify as conservative, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. The 80% who identify as liberal, meanwhile, teach students to hate our country and Western values. Harvard's medical and scientific research benefits all Americans, said Atul Gawande in The New Yorker. More than 90% of its federal funding flows support life-saving treatment at 5 affiliated hospitals such as Boston Children's and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. It also enables Harvard's Medical School and School of Public Health to conduct groundbreaking research on cancer, heart disease, diabetes, Parkinson's, and dementia. If you or someone you love has suffered from these afflictions, you've benefited from federally funded discoveries in care and treatment. The Trumpists don't care, said Andrew Prokop in Vox. In their nihilistic, anti-elitist worldview, choking off funds for pointy-headed woke scientists and doctors is just another delicious way to own the libs. Conservatives may shed a few tears for Harvard's elites, said The Washington Street Journal, but they should oppose this unprecedented attempt by government to micromanage a private university. The Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that federal funding cannot be used to force recipients to surrender constitutional rights. Harvard's right to hire its own faculty and set its own curriculum is one that conservatives should defend, unless they want to see a President Ocasio-Cortez one day defund conservative colleges or revoke the tax exemptions of religious schools. Trump should focus on the many actual responsibilities of the presidency. He has enough balls in the air without also trying to run Harvard. Only in America. A Texas school district has removed Virginia's state flag from its online learning platform because it depicts the bare breast of the Roman goddess Virtus. Lamar Consolidated Independent School District deleted a section about Virginia's history on the grounds that the flag violated the district's ban on visual depictions or illustrations of frontal nudity in elementary school materials. The flag, adopted in 1861, shows Virtus standing over a defeated tyrant above the state's motto, Sic Semper Tyrannis. A California mayor says he wants to give homeless people all the fentanyl they want to purge them from his city. R. Rex Paris, Republican mayor of Lancaster, conceded that it's harsh to encourage the fatal overdoses of homeless people who commit crimes, but it's my obligation as the mayor of the city of Lancaster to protect the hardworking families that live here, he said. It was a good week for good manners after OpenAI CEO Sam Altman said the human habit of saying please and thank you to soulless AI chatbots has an upside, even though it costs tens of millions in electricity and computing power for AI to respond in kind. Given the high stakes of the human-machine relationship in the future, Altman said, the cost of teaching AI to be polite is money well spent, adding ominously, you never know. It was a good week for prehistoric skin care after University of Michigan researchers concluded that early Homo sapiens may have used a form of sunscreen about 40,000 years ago. Topical applications of the pigment ochre may have helped early cave-dwelling humans survive during an age of increased atmospheric penetration by energetic particles. It was a good week for faint praise after President Trump said former President Jimmy Carter died a happy man because he knew he wasn't the worst U.S. president in history. Joe Biden was. It was a bad week for contraband after a pair of Belgian 19-year-olds were arrested in Nairobi and charged with attempting to smuggle 5,000 ants out of the country for sale on the black market. It was a bad week for hopping after an engine fire that forced the emergency landing of a United Airlines flight from Denver was blamed on a wild rabbit that got sucked into the plane's second engine during takeoff and caused it to explode in a fireball. It was a bad week for deja vu after the postponement of Fyre Festival 2, a supposedly better-run luxury music festival than the shambolic 2017 original. Officials on the Mexican island of Isla Mujeres, where FF2 had been scheduled for May, said no concerts have been approved. This is an event that does not exist, the officials said. Phoenix, ice wars. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a GOP-backed state bill last week that would have blocked cities and schools from limiting immigration enforcement efforts. The Arizona Immigration Cooperation and Enforcement, ICE Act, would have overridden rules like that of the Phoenix Union High School District, which in January barred immigration enforcement agents from its schools. The ICE Act would also have required all state and local officials and law enforcement agencies to assist with ICE detainers. Written requests from the agency that ask local law enforcement to hold migrants in jail for 48 hours beyond their scheduled release to turn them over to federal immigration officers. Hobbs, a Democrat, suggested the GOP priority bill would enable federal overreach. Arizonans, not Washington, D.C. politicians, must decide what's best for Arizona. Republicans in other states have passed similar bills. By contrast, Democratic-leaning Colorado is considering a bill that would block immigration agents from schools, jails, and hospitals without a warrant. Tallahassee, campus carnage. A mass shooting last week left 2 people dead and 6 wounded at Florida State University. Phoenix Eichner, the 20-year-old stepson of a Leon County sheriff's deputy, opened fire at FSU's student union. He killed FSU dining coordinator Robert Morales and Tiru Chaba, a South Carolina man visiting the campus. 5 people were injured by gunfire and 1 was hurt fleeing. Police quickly arrived, shooting Eichner within 4 minutes of his first shot. He was hospitalized and faces charges including first-degree murder. He was known for spreading white supremacist rhetoric and had a drawing of Adolf Hitler as a profile photo online. His stepmother, Deputy Jessica Eichner, practiced shooting with him and he used one of her weapons at FSU. Madison Askins, 23, said, "The minute I got shot, I remembered my parents telling me I just need to play dead. I didn't want him to shoot me again." Washington, D.C., state shakeup. Secretary of State Marco Rubio this week revealed a plan to dramatically reorganize his department in an effort to undo decades of bloat and root out radical political ideology. The move was part of the Trump administration's broader shift away from foreign aid and global leadership. The plan will cut U.S.-based staff by 15%, eliminating 700 positions and 132 offices, targeting programs focused on human rights, war crimes, and democracy. It also aims to eliminate the office of the Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights. President Trump has long criticized the State Department as a center of liberal activism, and his advisors consider that office the prime culprit. As a senator, Rubio had been a GOP champion of foreign aid, but the Trump administration has made drastic cuts across the board, including the virtual elimination of USAID. The State Department has 80,000 employees globally, and further layoffs and closures of diplomatic missions are expected to follow. San Salvador, El Salvador. Propaganda photo. Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland, said his visit last week with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Salvadoran migrant mistakenly deported by the Trump administration to the notorious Cicot prison in El Salvador, was exploited by Salvadoran authorities for propaganda. Authorities first denied Van Hollen's request to see Abrego Garcia, who entered the U.S. illegally as a teenager and lived in Maryland for years, but then they brought him to the senator's hotel. President Nayib Bukele, who claims without evidence that Abrego Garcia is a gang member and refuses to release him, then posted mocking photos of the meeting captioned, "Miraculously risen from the death camps and torture, now sipping margaritas." Van Hollen said those photos were staged and that nobody drank anything. He said Abrego Garcia told him that while conditions in Cicot had traumatized him, he'd been moved to a better facility. Moscow, possible peace talks. Under pressure from President Trump, both Russia and Ukraine said this week they were open to direct negotiations to end their war, though they remained far apart on the terms. Russian President Vladimir Putin dropped his opposition to talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who he has called an illegitimate leader for remaining in office past his term. Zelensky said he was ready for any conversation that would end strikes on civilians, but noted that Russian forces continued to blast civilian areas with deadly missile and drone strikes during what Putin said would be a 30-hour Easter ceasefire. Last week, Trump said that if the two sides can't reach a deal soon, the U.S. might decide that we're just going to take a pass on helping to mediate. Woods' unorthodox asset. Amy Lou Woods' career has been on an upward trajectory for a while, but it's her recent turn playing the sunny and slightly kooky Chelsea in The White Lotus that has propelled her to global fame, said Alice Jones in the Sunday Times of the UK. For Wood, a 31-year-old from Manchester, the part felt like a chance to embrace her goofy, nerdy side, which she sometimes tries to suppress. But over the course of 7 months, filming the murder mystery on set in a luxury hotel in Thailand, she began to wonder whether she ought to look more Hollywood. One moment especially was a catalyst for this. One day, the camera guy came up to me and said, she adopts an earnest American accent, "That choice you made with Chelsea's run? Genius." And I was like, "Frank, that's my run. I didn't make a choice. I just ran." "It's like when you're a kid," she adds. "You don't know you're weird until someone points it out." Something similar has happened with her un-American teeth, which have recently become an international talking point. Vanity Fair has declared them inspiring. Orthodontists on TikTok have explained her diastema and her incompetent lips, and Saturday Night Live has mocked them. "It does feel a bit weird," says Wood, "that the thing she got bullied for at school is still the thing that's defining me." Ham's winding path. For John Hamm, things often take time, said Austin Considine in the New York Times. The actor rose to fame relatively late in Hollywood terms after hooking the role of the enigmatic Don Draper in Mad Men in his mid-30s. I was a late bloomer in every sense, Ham says. His mother died when he was 10, and he lost his father a decade later. His life has shared some of the darkness of Draper's. For a long time, Ham says, he wasn't able to really participate in life in the way that my friends had normal adolescences. He was, as his therapist used to say, kind of surviving. When Mad Men ended, the strains and struggles returned. Ham kept working, but often in supporting roles, and when he did get star turns on the big screen, the results were middling. His personal life was plagued by demons. He separated from his longtime partner and entered rehab for alcohol addiction, and reporters dug up an old fraternity incident in which Ham was charged with hazing, but ultimately not convicted. Now he's finally part of the conversation again, starring as another brooding character trying to hold on to success in his new Apple TV Plus show, Your Friends and Neighbors. There's no way over but through, right? Ham says. Part of the challenge is having the wherewithal, having the confidence to say, it's going to take a minute. Haley Joel Osment apologized last week for an anti-Semitic outburst captured on police body cam footage while he was being arrested for public intoxication at a California ski lodge. In the footage, the Sixth Sense actor can be heard calling the arresting officer both an anti-Semitic slur and a effing Nazi. He was later charged with possession of cocaine and disorderly conduct. Osment, 37, said he was absolutely horrified by his behavior, saying his disgraceful choice of words occurred in the throes of a blackout. He said he was still reeling emotionally from the past few months of loss and displacement, having lost his Altadena, California home in January's Eaton fire, but added that that's no excuse for his behavior. I've let the Jewish community down and it devastates me, he said. I don't ask for anyone's forgiveness, but I promise to atone for my terrible mistake. Punk rock legend Patti Smith was an incredibly rude restaurant customer in the 1970s, according to Keith McNally, a restaurateur who has owned several iconic establishments in New York City. In his forthcoming book, I Regret Almost Everything, a memoir, excerpted in New York Magazine, McNally describes how Smith and her close friend, the artist Robert Mapplethorpe, would frequent 1/5, which was then the most fashionable restaurant in Manhattan. He says the two could be very difficult to wait on, and that Smith in particular would belittle the staff. It's impossible for me to listen to a Patti Smith song today, he writes, without remembering her reducing a waitress to tears because she forgot to put bread on the table. Kristen Stewart tied the knot this week, marrying her partner Dylan Meyer after a nearly 4-year engagement. Family and friends, including actress Ashley Benson, reportedly attended the intimate ceremony at an L.A. restaurant. Stewart, 35, an Oscar-nominated actress who rose to international stardom following her leading role in Twilight, had high-profile relationships with several of her male co-stars over the years. In 2019, she began seeing Meyer, 37, the screenwriter daughter of director Nicholas Meyer of 1983's The Day After. Stewart told Howard Stern in 2021 that the two were engaged, that Meyer had proposed to her exactly as she would have wished, and that the couple wanted celebrity restaurateur Guy Fieri to officiate. As it turned out, Fieri didn't make the wedding. China, the other superpower to trade with. Donald Trump's chaotic global trade war has given Beijing the space to present itself as the only adult in the room, said Hanjin Liu in Asia Times of Hong Kong. The U.S. president's blanket imposition of tariffs on nearly all countries undermined U.S. credibility. Beijing wants the world to see it as a hero, insisting its pushback, in the form of tit-for-tat levies of 125% on U.S. goods, is the reason Trump backed down and paused most of his tariffs on the rest of the world. China is now courting closer cooperation from its Asian neighbors and from Europe, urging them not to be pressured by Trump into breaking with Chinese manufacturers. Let us be the leader of global trade, it says. Normally, other countries wouldn't fall for such blatant Chinese propaganda. But with Trump making America's friends feel they have no one to count on, it's easier for Beijing to sell its version of the truth. China is eager to step into America's former leadership role, said Ming Pao of Hong Kong in an editorial. It just held its first economic talks in years with Japan and South Korea, two key U.S. allies, and President Xi Jinping visited Vietnam, Malaysia, and Cambodia last week in an effort to poach more U.S. clients. Like the U.S., China has a huge domestic market with a complete supply chain and industrial chain. It hopes to recruit new partners to build a prosperous and stable future no matter what obstacles the U.S. throws in its way. Middle powers like Malaysia might be risking America's wrath by embracing China, said Nathaniel Tan in the Star of Malaysia. But the U.S. is starting to look like an aging empire that is crumbling under its own weight, with Trump turning Americans against one another. Since defeating communism, the U.S. has hurtled into an unchecked pursuit of wealth and is now run by billionaires who are making everyone else poorer. The rest of the world has no choice but to seek out alternative markets and, if need be, alternative world orders, at least until the best of America triumphs over Trumpism. Compromises with Beijing will undoubtedly be necessary to contain American disorder, said Le Monde of France in an editorial. But China is in no position to lecture anybody. It is one of the world's major abusers of human rights, having locked up over a million Muslim minority Uyghurs in re-education camps. And it has never been a true proponent of free markets, what with a trade policy engineered to sell at all costs overproduction that sluggish demand cannot absorb. Getting enmeshed there will increasingly threaten jobs in Europe, as in many other countries. It's understandable that many countries want to teach the Americans a lesson and make a little money, said Edward Lucas in LRT of Lithuania. But Trump's missteps pale in comparison with China's ruthlessly mercantilist trade policies and other market distortions and systematic theft of intellectual property. That's on top of its Orwellian surveillance policies, ruthless suppression of minority rights, and threats against Taiwan. Even those who find America First distasteful will like China First even less. Resistance. AOC and Sanders hit the road. There's a long list of liberal politicians who are mad as hell, said John Henriksen in The Atlantic, but Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, are two of the few who genuinely aren't going to take it anymore. They've been crisscrossing the country on the Fighting Oligarchy tour, drawing at least 200,000 people to their rallies. They're visiting blue and red states alike, filling stadiums in Arizona, Idaho, and Montana. The American left's favorite double act is filling the void of opposition left by Democratic leadership. Sanders has been railing against billionaires for decades, but his rhetoric has never been more resonant as the stock market nosedives and Elon Musk, the world's richest man, guts the federal bureaucracy. At 83, Sanders is nearing his career's end, but 35-year-old Ocasio-Cortez is hitting her prime, raising questions about a presidential run in 2028. We need a Democratic Party that fights harder for us, she said to 36,000 people in Los Angeles. She and Sanders are attacking apathy, even if that means targeting timid Democrats. All this might please the rally-goers, but it's not exactly a fresh shtick, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Since January, Democratic voters have sought futile emotive gestures from their representatives, and these two are the first to supply them. Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez play to their Democratic Socialist base by blaming every woe on economic inequality. Of course, their magical misery tour is packing arenas, but it only proves the market for retributive paranoia is not yet saturated. Not everyone is feeling the burn, said Perry Bacon Jr. in the Washington Post. This tour's success doesn't mean rank-and-file Democrats are clamoring for the party to become more progressive. What they want are leaders who will not be so hesitant to take on President Trump and Elon Musk. The fear of Trump's retaliation cuts across parties. We are all afraid, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Representative Alaska, said last week. Democrats are looking for fighters who will overcome those fears. It will take a mass counter-movement to combat Trump, said David Brooks in the New York Times. AOC and Sanders provide a hint of something larger, but their partisan rallies make this look like a normal contest between Democrats and Republicans, and what's happening isn't normal. I'm not a movement guy and don't naturally march, but Trump is shackling the greatest institutions in American life. We have nothing to lose but our chains. Musk seeding the earth with his offspring. Elon Musk has famously fathered 14 children with four women, said Dana Mattioli in the Wall Street Journal. But the total number of his kids is likely far higher. And, according to multiple sources, he is constantly hunting for more women to impregnate. The 53-year-old tech billionaire and MAGA hatchet man believes declining birth rates imperil humanity and has taken on the mission of helping seed the earth with more human beings of high intelligence. His goal, he told conservative influencer Ashley St. Clair, 26, in an email, is to create a legion of offspring before the apocalypse. St. Clair said that Musk contacted her via X, impregnated her, and offered her a $15 million payment and $100,000 a month in exchange for complete secrecy, a deal he canceled when she publicly revealed his paternity and hired a lawyer. He has set up a compound in Austin for some of the mothers of his children and the kids and employs a fixer to deal with the harem drama. Musk apparently considers women nothing more than walking wombs, said Arwa Madawi in The Guardian. Since he is busy rearranging the U.S. according to his worldview, understanding the warped mindset of Musk and his fellow pronatalists has become a matter of public interest. There is a difference between being pronatalist and being pro-family, said Elizabeth Brunig in The Atlantic. Falling birth rates are genuinely concerning, but Musk is invested not in the creation of healthy, loving households. Instead, he's driven by the conviction that intelligent people in particular ought to be breeding more to compete with their genetic inferiors. That eugenic mindset is typical of the pronatalist movement's techno-libertarian wing, whose members frequently indulge in racist diatribes about the need to numerically outnumber non-white immigrants. For Musk, fatherhood ends at conception. Except for photo ops with his four-year-old son, Xaea Shi, whom he calls his emotional support human. Despite his wealth and power, Musk is clearly a pathetic antisocial freak, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. He pays women to make babies with him that he largely ignores, and many of his baby mamas find him unbearable. Like so many other men in the right-wing manosphere, he's an insecure misogynist who is alienated from normal human interaction. His millions of fanboys should note, being like Musk means being alone. an Ozempic-style drug in pill form. Patients may soon get the benefits of Ozempic by simply swallowing a pill, the New York Times reports. Eli Lilly said its new GLP-1 pill, orforglipron, appears to lower blood sugar and promotes weight loss in diabetics as effectively as popular injectable drugs. In a clinical trial, more than 500 people with type 2 diabetes were given either orforglipron or a placebo for 40 weeks. Those who received the medication saw their blood sugar levels drop by the same amount as in trials of injectables Ozempic and Mounjaro. 65% of those taking the pill saw their blood sugar levels reach the normal range. New plastic created from plants. Scientists have developed a plant-based material that could offer an environmentally friendly alternative to see-through plastic, reports New Scientist. Biochemist Noriyuki Isobe and his team at the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology developed the product called transparent paperboard from cellulose, a fibrous compound that makes up the walls of plant cells. Cellulose is already used to make transparent wraps such as cellophane, but that's too flimsy for most applications. Isobe's team found a way to stiffen the material by treating it with lithium bromide. A cup made of the resulting paperboard can hold just boiled water for over 3 hours with minimal leakage. It is not only shapeable, but also has the potential to serve as a sustainable alternative to conventional plastics, said Isobe. While plastic can take centuries to break down, leaching toxins and clogging our oceans and waterways, transparent paperboard degrades completely within 300 days in the ocean and even more quickly in shallower water. And it can be made not only from virgin plant cellulose, but from cellulose pulled from recycled materials, including discarded clothing. That means, the scientists say, it can play a pivotal role in the sustainable circular economy of the future. Why a pet's as good as a raise? Owning a pet makes you as happy as being married or earning an extra $90,000 a year, a new study has found. Researchers from Britain's University of Kent drew on data from a nationally representative survey in which members of 2,500 British households were asked how satisfied they were with their lives. It turned out that living with a cat or dog to cuddle was associated with an increase of 3 to 4 points on a scale of 7, with 1 being miserable and 7 being perfectly content. The team then used a technique devised by economists to translate intangible assets, such as living near a park, into monetary worth to reach the equivalence of a $90,000 a year boost. While that figure may seem high, other studies have assigned a similar cash value to regular social activity, such as simply catching up with friends once or twice a week. Given that pets are considered by many as best friends and family members, these values appear to be plausible, lead author Adelina Geschwantner, an economist, tells the Times of the UK. Many people don't actually realize how important their pets are for them. Book of the Week. Searches: Selfhood in the Digital Age by Vahini Vara. Though there's a growing pile of books that critique today's big tech overlords, Searches stands out for emphasizing how they've also shaped our private psychological terrain, said Mateo Wong in The Atlantic. Author Vahini Vara, a former Wall Street Journal tech reporter who has become a Pulitzer Prize-nominated novelist, came of age as the internet was just beginning to creep into everyday life, and she has woven together her life story and the history of the web as a way of underscoring how integral that technology has become to the very construction of self. Vara, like many of her readers, is both enchanted by the web and disgusted with the companies that control it. At the same time, she exposes the fragility of the technology, demonstrating that even AI is still just a parasite of humanity. She is equipped to take on these issues to an almost uncanny degree, said Hannah Bay in the San Francisco Chronicle. 4 years ago, Vara's essay Ghosts, in which she used GPT-3, a precursor to ChatGPT, to write about her sister's death from cancer, went viral. The essay is reprinted here, and it remains riveting to see how AI helped Vara share her painful memories, sometimes hitting on felicitous turns of phrases, even as it invented facts and made countless other mistakes. She enlists the technology in similar experiments here, including by having ChatGPT provide commentary after many passages, starting with her account of navigating an Oklahoma middle school as the daughter of Indian immigrants. Initially, I found these conversations painful to read because I fear writers could be replaced by AI. Fortunately, AI is still a terrible writer, and Vara proves again and again that nothing can make language sing like a gifted human mind. At times, though, Vara's book slides into tedium and banality, said Mina Venkatamaran in The Washington Post. At one point, she shares a list of her Google searches across a 10-year span: how to warm up pork chop, how to orgasm, who is Cardi B? And that five-page run feels endless. Searches also raises ethical questions about AI that are left unanswered. Mostly, though, Vara's account of her lifelong engagement with tech is at once genre-defying and gripping, and it offers a glimmer of quixotic hope that the Internet could one day be owned by the people, not a handful of corporations. How? Vara gives examples of nonprofits that operate search engines, message services, and the like. But she also grants herself the right to do what AI does, make things up. To call a proposed invention impossible, she writes, is as nonsensical as calling a declaration impossible, or a fiction, or a joke. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.